Holy moly.
No pressure.
No pressure. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Joe Bear. I'm a member of the Wednesday night Big Book Study Group that meets at Christ Church, right up the street. If you're going east or going west on Atlantic Boulevard, you can go to Northeast 2nd Avenue, make a right-hand turn, go three blocks, and Christ Church is on your right-hand side. We meet at 8 o'clock, and you can come and hear Keith do a fantastic job in facilitating the Big Book Study. We have a really good time. And I do have an announcement. I didn't want to raise my hand. I just figured I'd use the podium to do it. We're having a spaghetti dinner. We have one every year, which is, this year we're celebrating 30 years of our anniversary, 30 years of the group. And, yeah. We started by my sponsor, John W., a man I hold very dear in my heart and was really the guy that taught me everything that I know about life. And then he moved, and I've gotten some other very, very strong men in my life, mentors, champions of the Big Book, champions of God, and just wonderful men. But this meeting that we're going to have, this dinner, is to make contributions to Intergroup and District 9 and BCIC, and we're going to have Chris R. back. We had him in from Ingram, Texas. And if none of y'all ever heard Chris R., you really need to hear this guy. Phenomenal speaker. A lot of fun. So having said that, we're going to talk for the next 12 weeks on the steps of the book and the program of recovery. And, you know, I've probably prepped for about 2 hours today, and I don't remember anything. Nothing. God has a funny way of really scrambling my brains before I get up here. I've done this a few times, and it never fails. And even on Wednesday night when Keith and I do the deal, and, you know, I've been doing that for 7 years, and every time I get up there, I don't know where to start. I don't know what to do, but thank God I got a manual. You know, I have a manual. And this book is the program of recovery that changed my life. It literally took me from a person that felt like a complete zero to a level of life that I can't even imagine. And if what I've experienced in the last almost 11 years is any indication of what's to come, I'm ready. You know what I mean? I'm excited about tomorrow. I'm excited about what's going to happen in my life. And I'm going to be honest with you. I could be driving home tonight and get taken. You know, I could leave this earth. And I can tell you, from the bottom of my heart, I will have no regret. I will have no remorse, no shame, no guilt, none of it. I'm ready. I'm ready to go. I've prepared myself. That's a miracle given, coming from a guy who was so lost and so beaten, so mangled, after years of going in and out of this program trying to get this thing. And there's many in this room. There's a lot of my closest, dearest friends, brothers and sisters, that know me and knew me back when I was going through my plight. And, you know, I believe God will do anything to us as individuals. And He will allow us to suffer the pain that we need to suffer in order for us to have a truly intimate, authentic, transparent relationship with Him. And that just means to me that I must die to my old self to become somebody new. I know, you know, I knew by the time I had gotten here that it was what I knew that was killing me. And that it was what I didn't know that was going to save my life. Because I had a very kind gentleman that would get in my face and tell me the truth regardless of how I felt about it. He didn't care about my feelings. He didn't care. He was more concerned with me living life than dying. See, we're all going to die. You know, we're all going to die. We all have an exit date. The question isn't if we're going to die or not. The question is how are we going to live. You know what I mean? What kind of legacy will we be able to leave behind in the hearts and minds of other people to where we left them with empowerment and enlightenment and encouragement and strength? legacy. I can tell you that prior to 2002, September 14th, if I would have died before I got sober, I would have left a life and a legacy of pain and disappointment and despair and agony in the hearts and minds of the people that love me. So there are consequences to our behavior. And, you know, prior to getting here and we hear Russell, I mean, we've had some tremendous speakers for the last couple of months come in here and share their experience, strength, and hope with respect to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I can hardly carry their water, but I'm glad to do so. And I believe that with proper sponsorship and proper desire, based on the pain that we suffered when we got here, that we will immerse ourselves into this thing and desire to live life differently. Because there's no possibility of change if I don't, you know, if I don't desire to change. I'm going to gravitate to what I always knew. Something that I read quite often on the Wednesday night study group for our meditation. We do things a little bit different there if anybody's ever been there. We begin our meeting with a narrative. We close everybody down. We have everybody close their eyes. And Keith and I will read some type of a meditation followed by a piece of music to which the lyrics speak very, very directly to that stage of whatever we're doing in the book at that time. And one of the things that I really love is this piece right here. It says, "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes up short again and again. Because there is no effort without error on shortcoming. But who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself for a worthy cause? Who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement? And who at the worst, if he fails, at least he fails while daring greatly. So that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who knew neither victory nor defeat." This thing that we're in, this process of recovery, demands participation. See, I was always that kind of guy that wanted to come in here and sit around and do nothing, put the minimal input and expect the maximum output. I wanted my life to change without me having to do it. And for 16 years, from 1986 until 2002, I floundered in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous 3 months, 6 months, and 9 months, and maybe, you know, there was always variable amounts of time, but they never really got to any point like beyond a year. And that was for 16 years. And I would come in, and I would listen, and I would judge, and I would be critical. And I would pick and choose what I would buy into and what I wouldn't, which what I would buy into was very minimal. And then the day would come where drinking became a good idea, or drugging became a good idea. I didn't know what was wrong with me. And I think there's a lot of people in here that don't know what's wrong with them. See, I know that there's a few different types of people that are sitting in this room tonight. Those that have had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, that have enjoyed that glimpse into the fourth dimension of existence, that operate on a sixth sense, that know that they do know, that know that they do know that God is doing for them what they could not do for themselves. And when they hear what I'm saying, see, it's what Russell shared, it's what Steve, we all talk about the same thing. If you've gotten that prize and you've gotten a glimpse into that realm that they talk about, it's all you want to talk about. It's all you want to talk about. So there will be people here that will acknowledge what I'm saying, and you know, they'll nod their heads and like, yeah, it's like, you know, you're listening and you're going, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then there's those in here that are hearing it for the very first time. There's also people in here that have heard it over and over and over, but have never desired to make the sacrifices and pay the prices to do the seeking that's necessary in order to realize the dream. Usually they're the people that are walking around looking like they've been hit in the face with a dead fish, complaining about everybody else, always negative, always having something to say about somebody or something. And the only people that they can sell that stuff to is other people that have the same stuff going on. And as Russell says, they're just hanging in there, one precious day at a time, selling out, settling for mediocrity. And they're not going for the dream. We all have to see. I believe that if you don't realize what's wrong with you, like I didn't realize what was wrong with me, I'm not going to make this commitment to seek this power. Anything that good that comes from me comes from this power that I invited into my life 10 and a half years ago, a little over 10 and a half years ago. I got on my knees with my sponsor and I invited this God that I didn't understand to come into my life and please spare me of the agony and the torture that I was suffering from on the inside. See, you all didn't know I was suffering. I was just pretending. You could ask me, how you doing, Joe? I'd say, great, and be dying inside. I didn't realize I was suffering from this internal condition that had compiled itself from when I was a little boy. When I started to formulate these old attitudes, ideas, and beliefs that dominated my thinking and dictated all the choices and all the decisions that I made in my life. I was taught about God, but those payoffs did not come nearly quick enough for me in order for me to intentionally seek and pursue a relationship with that God. I like the worldly stuff. You know what I mean? I like the instant gratification. Because I saw other people had it, and that's what I wanted. So I'm going to talk to you for the next 12 weeks about what I understand and what I've been taught and what I've come to gain clarity on and have revealed to me through study, through intensive study, and through intensive counsel with people that know about what my dilemma is. So that they could put this thing into context for me, and perhaps I could communicate that to you. Because we all suffer from a death sentence. Maybe there's people in here that don't. You've got to find out if you truly have this thing or if you don't. Because if you don't, there's no need to make a decision. There's no need to make a decision to seek this power, which will solve all your problems. Or if you don't think you have the problem, you're certainly not going to do it with everything you've got, like your life's on the line. Okay? The first thing that they tell us in this thing is that this is a book of instruction. A forward to the first edition says that we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered. So let's end that debate for anybody that might be in treatment and having that debate in treatment or group therapy. Or maybe not. Maybe you're out of treatment. Maybe you've been out for a few years and you're still having that debate. There is no debate. But what we've recovered from is a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. So the main purpose of this book is to precisely give us instructions on how to recover. Do you know that we have such a wonderful fellowship? And I'm going to hopefully make some distinctions between our fellowship and our program. But we have such a wonderful fellowship that in our preamble, We tell people that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Well, you just got to know that you can have the desire to stop drinking and relapse, or I'm sorry, retox 364 of those days and come to every day and have a desire to stop drinking, go to a meeting, and they'll let you in. But if you truly want to recover from a hopeless condition of mind and body, there are a set of directions for that. They're not suggestions. If you're dying and you want to find a level of life beyond your wildest imagination, there's very clear-cut directions on how to do that, instructions. So they say that this is a basic text. A textbook is a book of instruction. Listen, I could get up here and try to tell you about chemistry and fall flat on my face. I don't know anything about chemistry. I took chemistry in college, and I couldn't tell you one chemical formula, not one. I couldn't even tell you the chemical formula of booze. I can tell you the payoff. It would take a chemist that has studied a book of instruction on chemistry in order to tell you about that, where you might learn something about it. The only way I can tell you about recovery is to have undergone this thing they call recovery. To have had this spiritual transformation. To have had this profound alteration in my reaction to life. To have this vast change in feeling and outlook. To go from who I had become into a completely different human being that I was when I walked through the door. I've had that experience. If anybody knew me back in the day, I had ended up on Broward Boulevard, homeless, with all my earthly possessions in a public shopping bag. And you know how big those are. Wasn't even my bag. I found it floating around somewhere. You know how they float around. I had nothing. And that started a 16-year pursuit in and out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous through detoxes, hospitals, jails, prison, halfway houses, 16 years. Obviously, there were things about me that needed to die in order for me to fully give myself to this simple program. There were parts of me and parts of my ego and pride and intellectual pride and philosophy of life that I wasn't willing to part with. Until I was dying. Until I was dying. So, when I came in here and John had asked me if I was ready, he called me and I was at Atlantic Shores Hospital in detox. And he says, when are you going to get it into your blankety-blank head? Draw your own conclusions. I don't cuss from the podium. That it's what you know that's killing you. In every domain of life. Not just recovery. Not just my understanding of how to get sober. But in intimate relationships. In career. In family. With God. With spirituality. Versus religion. In every domain. It had become what I knew that was killing me. And it was what I didn't know that was going to save my life. Listen, you come in here, you got to come in here, at least to my understanding, and find out what we don't know. We got to be teachable, right? How can you come in here thinking you know everything? I mean, listen, there's many of us that have tried that route. Wasn't working out real good. When I got here in 2002, I had nothing to lose. It was either God, give me a new reality or take me out. That was the prayer that I uttered. Give me a new reality or take me out. I can't do this anymore. I had an exit strategy. So, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. So I'm going to be talking about this book and nothing else. There's some other books. I mean, I got my little prop desk up here that, you know, I got stuff over here that hopefully will keep me on track. Maybe not, but I'm going to do the best I can. And so I'm going to do a lot of reading from some excerpts in this book. And hopefully those that don't know will know by the end of the night and be able to come to a simple conclusion, to be able to conclude a pertinent idea that we hear every single meeting at the end of how it works. And it's A, that we're alcoholic and couldn't manage our own life and know exactly what that means. And then we will venture into step two. Okay? So, just a little history. You know, back in 1935, we just celebrated our 78 years of being together when Bill met Bob. And, you know, Bill had gotten sober in Towns Hospital. And he met this little doctor named Dr. William D. Silkworth. They called him Silky. And he was a medical director at a nationally renowned hospital for the treatment of addiction. Okay? There weren't too many of those back in that day, especially on the Eastern Seaboard. And when Bill had gone through there, in the course of his third treatment, it says he acquired certain ideas as a possible means of recovery. Well, prior to that visit, and I hope I can connect some dots for you to show you how divinely put together this program was put together. It's not an accident, okay, that we're here tonight. Abby Thatcher was a childhood friend of Bill and drank with Bill. And Bill felt, you know, and he's written in his memoirs that he felt Abby was worse than he was. More hopeless than he was. And Abby was going to get committed for alcoholic insanity. And he heard of Bill's plight. He had gotten involved. What happened was he was going to get committed. He was going to court. Just so happened that the two men that went to court for Abby were from the Oxford movement. One of them's name was Roland Hazard. The other one's name was Siebert Graves. Just so happened that the judge that was going to preside over Ebby's case was Judge Graves, Siebert's daddy. Okay? Ebby had committed, Ebby was so ripe for being committed for life. You know what I mean? It's not like it was his first offense. He was ready to go. You know how like the point system is now, where you like get so many points and like you can steal a buttercup and go to prison for life? That's kind of like where Ebby was back then. So Roland and Siebert go and they have Ebby released to the Oxford movement, which at that time was a first century Christian organization for spiritual regeneration. All right? And Ebby calls on Bill. That's when, if everybody knows the story, when Bill was sitting in his kitchen drinking, Ebby shows up fresh skinned and glowing, Bill says. There was something about his eyes. You know how we change when we get sober? Like the sparkle comes back. The red comes out. We start to get full of life again. Beware, because that's when the ego takes back over. Okay? But Ebby told Bill, you know, he had this conversation with him. And Bill was aghast. Ebby said, "I got religion." And Bill was shocked. Religion, what's that all about? So they had this little conversation, and Bill thought he was there to evangelize him and convert him to Ebby's religion. And Ebby said something novel. He says, "Why don't you form your own conception of God?" And right there he took the argument away about how Bill was in a state of mind that was only one of, I guess you can consider it as savage. He was at war with this whole concept of God thing. So Bill didn't get sober, but he went to Towns Hospital for the third time, and Ebby visited him and gave him the six tenets of the Oxford movement. Bill worked those tenets and had a white light experience in Towns Hospital. And when Bill got out of the hospital, he went to try and save the world. He was going to alcoholics everywhere, trying to get them sober. The only problem was, is Bill was telling them that they needed to have this white light experience. That they needed to come to this profound understanding of God. And people weren't buying it. Just like a lot of us wouldn't have bought it. So he goes back to this doctor. And he says, "Doc," he says, I'm at the end. I don't know how I can do this any longer. You know what I mean? I'm at the end of my rope." And Dr. Silkworth says, "Well, what are you telling these people?" He says, "Well, I'm telling them about the white light experience. You've got to have this major conversion." Silkworth says, man, what are you doing? He says, you got to tell these people about the nature of their problem. You got to give them a reason to find this spiritual approach palatable. You got the cart before the horse. I'm going to just read you something from Language of the Heart. This is really powerful stuff. So, it says, finally one day Dr. Silkworth took me back down to my right size. Said he, Bill, why don't you quit talking so much about that bright light experience of yours? It sounds too crazy. How can you tell a drunk something like that? You can't talk to alcohol anyway, you know, but though I'm convinced that nothing but better morals and alcohol will make alcoholics really well, I think that you have the cart before the horse. The point is that alcoholics won't buy all this moral exhortation until they convince themselves that they must. If I were you, I'd go after them on the medical basis first. While it has never done any good for me to tell them how fatal their malady is, it might be a very different story if you, a formerly hopeless alcoholic, gave them the bad news. Because of the identification you naturally have with alcoholics, you might be able to penetrate where I can't. Give them the medical business first, and listen to this, and give it to them hard. Like with a sledgehammer. Okay? This might soften them up so they will accept the principles that will really get them well. If you don't understand the nature of this deal and what lies within your skin, why are you going to seek God's already a sore subject. Why are you going to seek a spiritual experience or spiritual transformation to get well? Right? So Silkworth gave us, you know, Bill had him give us this medical opinion. And it goes into the nature of our sickness. So basically, those of you that don't know quite what's wrong with you, hopefully will be able to come to the conclusion that this may be your problem. It's simply making a decision on whether this is the way you drank or this isn't the way things went. Okay? All right. So it says this. This is in his second letter. It says, the physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. It says, in this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. So if you're sitting out there and you're wondering if you got this thing, this is something that you have to come to conclusions that you must believe, okay? That the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It didn't satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. It says the doctor's theory, this was a theory back then, that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. Back then, and in a lot of cases today, people looked at us like immoral, weak-willed sinners. That no, there is no reason that we shouldn't be able to look at the evidence and clearly summon the willpower to straighten out our lives. That we should be able to will this thing away. And Silkworth treated over 40,000 alcoholics, it's estimated. And he saw patterns with us. He saw things that were happening with people like us. And he comes to the conclusion, he goes, you know what? I get the will thing and I get the mind thing, but I think something else is going on here. And what he uses the word allergy because it fit. An allergy in Webster simply defined as an abnormal reaction to a food, a beverage, or a substance. That when an alcoholic ingests alcohol, something happens within the body of an alcoholic that doesn't happen in a normal temperate drinker. And what happens is he called it this phenomenal craving for more alcohol. Now think about when we started. Were you able to stop, or were you able to control the amount you took once you began? No matter what you said you were going to do, I'll only have a six-pack, I'll only go out for an hour, I'll only do this, I'll only do that. Were you able to stop once you started? Or were you able to control the amount once you started? Now, I don't care what your drug of choice is, whether it's a drug alcohol or the drug something else. If this fits for you, you've got the first piece of this deal. Okay? And so we have since learned that it's a physical demand, a physiological demand that's created within the alcoholic through this chemical reaction that when we drink alcohol, we have little control over the amount we take once we start. Does it fit for you? You just have to ask yourself that deal, okay? He says that the action of alcohol is a manifestation of an allergy. So like, you know, a lot of us have allergies. You have an allergy to penicillin, you get injected with penicillin. Typically what happens is your body swells, your windpipe closes, and you suffocate and die. That swelling is the manifestation to the ingestion of penicillin. As with alcohol, when an alcoholic takes a drink of alcohol, the body will physiologically demand more alcohol, where what happens is, rather than drinking for effect or relief, you start to drink to overcome a craving that you can't overcome. So you have a body that can't drink successfully because of the allergy, and you have a mind that tells you you can. Okay? So if you can't stop once you start, and you can't stop starting, you'll understand you got a death sentence. What else can happen? I'm going to die an active alcoholic. And you got to know this. Our problem wasn't stopping. There's people in here that have stopped many times. I stopped on and off for 16 years, probably, I don't know, 20, 30 times. I've stopped by the cops. I've stopped by halfway out. I mean, I stopped a lot of times. My problem wasn't stopping. My problem was that I couldn't stop starting. Why couldn't I stop starting? Because I have this thing called an obsession of the mind. This thought or group of thoughts that in light of all the evidence, I can have a conversation all by myself that comes in the form of a lie where I can justify or rationalize and give myself permission to put the very poison in my body that's killing me. See, I know what happens when I start drinking. I usually end up homeless and on the street. But how can I be going 2 or 3 months where everything starts to straighten itself out just by simply not drinking and have the thought that comes into my mind on a clear blue day, not a cloud on the horizon, and say this to myself, man, wasn't that bad? You know, and I'm talking complete devastation. Wasn't that bad? Nobody will know. It'll be different this time. Now, mind you, I don't tell anybody else that I'm having that conversation. But if I'm in that state of mind, I'm done. I'm done. It's called untreated alcoholism. I always wondered why I couldn't get sober. What's wrong with me? 16 years of trying this thing. Man, I came in, I went to meetings and meetings and meetings. I was a poster child for the halfway house I was in, Mr. Complier, and I get drunk. Time after time after time. I didn't realize I was walking in and out of AA with untreated alcoholism and an alcoholic mind. Dr. Silkworth calls it this internal condition. That there's something else going on besides just having a problem with booze. I drink booze for a reason. But if I look at the facts, all over my lifetime, I have developed this internal condition as a result of the carnage of my alcoholism that has me harbor regret, shame, remorse, devastation, annihilation, loneliness, despair, failure. feeling like a loser, feeling like a zero, feeling like I'm not making any contribution, that it'll never work. This AA thing doesn't work. And he says that harboring of that stuff manifests itself. Kind of like the allergy thing. It causes something in my physical state and emotional state called restlessness, irritability, and discontentedness. I'm at war with the world. I feel like I'm never going to be forgiven for the devastation that I caused. People are always going to look at me the same way, so I thought. And the only thing that cures that, the only thing that kills that pain is one thing. One thing. Booze and drugs. It worked. My problem wasn't drinking and drugging. My problem was trying to stay sober without it. Trying to do this thing with an alcoholic mind and not changing and correcting that internal condition with God's help. That's what the rest of the steps are for. I have to identify who I had become. I have to find out who I had become, because if I don't, I'm not going to intentionally try to correct that thing. He says that we sense the ease and comfort that comes in a split second by taking a drink. Drinks we see other people taking without danger, with impunity. And I succumb. I give in to the desire again, because that internal condition is just making me feel like I'll never ever get this thing. Or that it's always going to be like this. And I give in. I succumb to the desire, the obsession. Silkworth called it a desire. Bill calls it an obsession. As so many do. As I did for 16 years. And I go through the stages of a well-known spree or binge, or tear, or whatever you want to call it. And he says, this is repeated over and over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, mind, body, and soul, there's very little hope of your recovery, Joe. And it's like, I stopped wondering why I couldn't get sober. I never went through an entire psychic change. I didn't think it was possible. But I had a man that stood for my life and said, it is absolutely possible, but you must be thoroughly ready to follow the path. You got to immerse yourself in this thing like it's the only life preserver in the middle of an ocean, and you're drowning. I came in this thing and I wanted to pick and choose my way through this thing, and there's things I wouldn't give up, things I would not even consider, and I failed. And I failed, and I failed. And I kept telling people when I'd come in, they'd say, hey, Joe, man, we're glad you're back. How you doing? Good to see you. What are you going to do different this time? They get tired of it. I'd look at them point blank in the face, say, I know what I need to do. Can you imagine how crazy that must have been? They'd probably want to take a hammer out and hit me in the head. All I knew how to do was fail. I only had so much information up here in how to seek recovery. It wasn't working. I was trying to be a chemist without ever cracking a book. You follow me? And the instruction manual was right here. Unbelievable. But you know what? There were some pieces of me that needed to die in order for me to become humble enough or humiliated enough to be taught. I had to become teachable. And that's where John came into play. But I had to know I was dying first. I wanted an entire psychic change. I hated my guts when I got here. I couldn't look at myself in the eyes in the mirror. It was filthy in there. It was so dark and so dirty. I wanted a God that was going to forgive me. I wanted to feel forgiveness. I wanted to feel fellowship. I wanted to belong to something. I wanted to make a positive difference. I was that tornado. That guy that got to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous on September 14th of 2002 had to die. God knows I wanted to. Death was way more attractive for me than living at that point. I hated life. I hated me. Felt like a complete loser. You know what I mean? And I had to be willing to just follow direction. And, you know, thank God for John W. Because he showed me the way. He took me right to this book. So that's Dr. Silkworth's contribution, at least how it affected me. And then there's a solution. In the second chapter, we find out the difference between a moderate drinker, a hard drinker, and a real alcoholic. We'll talk about that next week. I don't know that first week will be step one, second week will be step two, third week will be step... I don't know how it's going to work out. But we're going to cover it, and we're going to get it done. Okay? But, if for anything tonight, if you're new here tonight, go back home, read the doctor's opinion, and get crystal clear about whether you suffer from this physical addiction to alcohol or whatever substance you used. Because if you don't come to that conclusion, not much hope there beyond. Okay? So next week we'll do something.